The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, our third hour this Thursday, November 14th, 602-508-0960. Impeachment proceedings will commence again on television tomorrow. And, I guess into next week, CNN and MSNBC have told us bombshells were thrown all over the place or exploding all over the place yesterday. I guess they're as serious as the constitutional crisis we're in that's been going on for more than a year now, as the Democrats keep telling us. If you don't have the goods, just say you have the goods. Basically, they're flim-flam artists. We'll talk about it. Interesting to me because I think it's a cover for what's going on in the Democratic presidential primary. I think the tale has been told. You heard AOC say it yesterday. You've heard Al Green, Democratic congressman from Texas, say it in May. They're trying to impeach the president because they don't think they can beat the president in 2020. And if you're the Democratic Party and you think you have a pretty robust field, pretty robust and diverse field, you've got women, you've got socialists, you've got people of color, you've got moderates, you've got leftists, you've got spiritual advisors to Oprah. You have a pretty wide swath to pick from: senators, governors, former senators, former vice president. Why are more trying to get in? The latest is Deval Patrick, former governor from Massachusetts, good friend of Barack Obama's. Can you imagine what Joe Biden must be thinking right now about his former boss? Prompted one editorial writer at the LA Times to write, "No, no, no, no. This whole Democratic nomination fight is going in the wrong direction. With the Iowa caucuses less than 3 months away, we should be more candidates dropping out, not jumping in." Yet here comes former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, who announced his candidacy today after a couple of days of speculation with former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who was so rich he could fit Donald Trump into his coin purse, hovering on the sidelines. Again, does this add anything to the options for the Democrats? Not really. Patrick is a former corporate lawyer for Texaco, always popular with the Democrats. His most recent job was with the investment firm Bain Capital, co-founded by another former Massachusetts governor and one-time Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney. Puts him on the wrong end of the income inequality scale for most Democrats. On that, John Hinderacher wrote, "A vulture capitalist enters the Democratic race. Former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick has announced his candidacy for the Democratic presidential nomination. That doesn't interest me much, but it is worth noting that Patrick resigned from Bain Capital yesterday, the day before he announced. Of course, there's nothing wrong with working for Bain. It's a perfectly good company. But remember the abuse that the Democrats heaped on Mitt Romney for running Bain Capital? He was, quote-unquote, a vulture capitalist. There was a TV ad showing he caused one woman to die of cancer. He fired many from their jobs. We see revealed here the utter cynicism and hypocrisy of the Democratic Party. The leaders of that party don't mean the things they say. They knew their attacks on Bain Capital were stupid. They just didn't care, just as they do not more generally believe their own demagoguery of Wall Street, when in fact Wall Street has been among the biggest financial supporters of the Democratic Party. The more time that goes by, the harder it is to see anything motivating the Democratic Party other than sheer lust for power." That's what I have to conclude. I mean, they were fine with Barack Obama and Joe Biden not giving arms to the Ukraine after Russia invaded, and even though head of the Ukraine pleaded for arms. And now they're mad at Donald Trump for not providing arms fast enough to the Ukraine. Yeah, I don't know what is motivating them. I know they have an ideology. I know they have an ideology that is either quasi-socialist or full-on socialist. That's clear. And I know they have a liberal social agenda, or a left-wing social agenda, if you want. And I think that is what motivates their anger more than anything else. When you consider the makeover of the court system that is happening under Donald Trump and that a re-election of Donald Trump will solidify, I think that more than anything else, though you don't really hear them talk about it, I think that more than anything else is what worries the Democrats and the left. They are going to lose their unelected bastion and redoubt of power, the court system, on social issues. They are in a radical campaign to remake America. Some are more vocal about it than others. Where do they do it? The courts. Why do they do it in the courts? Because people would never vote for the nonsense that they propose. And they know the courts, because of the left-wing march through the legal system and the ABA and our law schools, has given them a judiciary that is anodynely and softly put the philosophy of a living constitution. But I don't like that phrase much anymore. That phrase has too much credibility, a living and breathing constitution. What they mean is no constitution. What they mean is the whim or whimsy or caprice or really nothing more than the political judgment of the judge on the federal court in front of whom they bring their case. That's what they're talking about. And you can see this in any number of social policy issues. You can see it, frankly, in the immigration debate. The Democrats want as much immigration as possible. Illegal or legal, it doesn't matter to them. Elizabeth Warren herself has said she will stop the deportations of illegal immigrants. That is the view of a lot of people running for the presidency of the Democratic Party, including giving health care to illegal immigrants. They want illegal immigrants here. So comes this DACA deferred action, right? This deferred action program that was twice put in front of the Congress. Twice put in front of the Congress. When the Democrats ran the Senate, when Harry Reid was the majority leader and Barack Obama was president. And it doesn't even get out of the Senate. The Senate can't approve the Dream Act. Senate doesn't do it. Under a Democratic Senate, it can't do it because of the rules of the Senate and under a presidency of Barack Obama. So Barack Obama issues what is kindly referred to as an executive order. Mark Krikorian has it more accurately as a memo, but with the effect of the executive order. Everyone knows that an executive order is only as good as a president is willing to support it, and that you can undo by executive order what you do by executive order. It's not an act of Congress. So Donald Trump undoes Barack Obama's quote-unquote executive order. And the left finds lower courts that will say Donald Trump doesn't have the right to do that. It's now in front of the Supreme Court. It was argued in front of the Supreme Court this past week. I suspect that Donald Trump's constitutional authority to do this will be approved of by the Supreme Court. Possibly 6-3. Likely 5-4. Possibly 6-3. Because it is such a clear-cut case and such a clear political power grab for the left to go to the courts whenever they lose at the ballot box. And that's what they do. And they've remade American society. They have remade American society through the court system, something the court system was never meant to do. As Alexander Hamilton put it in the Federalist Papers, the third branch of government, the judiciary, was supposed to be the least powerful branch. The left has made it the most powerful. unelected and it's unaccountable, which is why the voting for president is so important these days. Because you can continue down that path of empowering the courts by voting for Democrats, or you can continue the path of restoration of a constitutionalism and a constitutional order where the courts call balls and strikes based on true constitutional violations, based on what the Constitution says and not what a left-wing judge wishes it said. That's what animates them. That's what all of this is really about. I'm Seth, 602-5080-960. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I am Seth. Of course, all of this we're talking about, understanding of civics, understanding of the courts, understanding everything about this country, comes back to my personal and I think politically deep in implication concern about the state of teaching and the state of knowledge, particularly about American civics and American history. I'm delighted. U of A and ASU and NAU take this seriously, at least the notion of civics and debate. They're engaging in a big debate contest this weekend down at the U of A. We talked about it last week, and they invited me to be a judge. I'm excited to be going down to Tucson to do that with these bright young college students who think the First Amendment means something. And American civics means something, because it does. It means everything. Cal Thomas, remember him, columnist? Used to be the most popularly read columnist in America. I don't know that he still is, but he once upon a time was. He's still writing. He writes that according to the National Assessment of Education Progress, the nation's report card you hear me talk about, the teaching of U.S. history to American students lags behind all other subject matters. Regular listeners of this show know that. And then he talks about the data. He talks about what the proficiency scores are for 4th, 8th, and 12th graders in American history. And that's one way to look at it. I look at the failure scores. I look at their failure rates because I think that tells the bigger tale. 27% of 4th graders would get an F in American history. 29% of 8th graders get an F in American history. And 55% of high school seniors, 12th graders, get an F in American history. Which, if you look at that trajectory and those numbers, tells a pretty sad tale. It means the longer you stay in school, the worse you do in American history. Doesn't that frighten? Doesn't that concern? Cal Thomas goes on to write, part of this, I suspect, is the way the subject is taught. History is boring to many students. Who wants to read about a bunch of dead white men one cannot view on video or see in high-res photographs? I asked David Rubenstein about this. He's the head of the Carlyle Group and has a new book out, The American Story, Conversations with Master Historians, where he interviews everyone from Doris Kearns Goodwin to David McCullough. All have written highly readable biographies that metaphorically raise America's founders and other important historical figures from the dead, making readers feel they are in the same room where they speak to us today. Why does Mr. Rubenstein think U.S. history is taking a backseat to every other subject? He replied, to some extent it started after Sputnik in 1957, when people were concerned that our science and technology were not as good as the Soviets. Then when China came along as an economic and technological threat, the emphasis on science and technology and engineering and mathematics became a bigger deal. Also, I think parents said to their children, make sure you study something that will get you a job when you graduate. All of this made history go down, and therefore we don't teach it very much. Mr. Rubenstein tells me this is not in his book, but something he finds shocking. Today you can graduate from any college in the United States without having to take an American history course, and you can graduate as a history major in 80% of the colleges and not have to take an American history course. As if this were not stunning enough, he adds a recent survey revealed that If one is foreign-born and wishes to become a citizen, you have to be a resident for 5 years. Used to be 14. After 5 years, you take a test. 91% of the people pass. Same test was given to native-born citizens in all states. A majority failed in every state except Vermont. This shows you how bad the situation is. Mr. Rubenstein says when history is taught, it is more about world civilization than American history. While he says he doesn't think learning about other countries is a bad idea, it's good to know your own history. I do find, as I travel around the world, that people know more about American history than people in the United States do. While he won't comment on the role political correctness has played in the spinning of American history, the stories one hears coming from public schools and universities seems to confirm the facts of Americans' past are being revised to reflect a liberal and contemporary view. That is because some of the founders owned slaves, and explorers like Christopher Columbus are said to have wrecked a society of indigenous people, and these stains can never be washed away. Cal's really close to it, though, but he is missing one part here. He's missing a big part here. When you downgrade and make deplorable American history, why would there be any interest in teaching it or studying it or taking it seriously when you can just wash it away, whitewash it, wipe it away, exclude it as the story of misery and oppression? That's what's been done by our textbooks. Why would you want to study and endeavor to study and have a thirst for something that's deplorable? Why would you want to study that? Who would? Of course, that's the problem. What's interesting, though, is that the professional historians that David Rubenstein interviews, you know, Doris Kearns Goodwin, David McCullough, Jay Winnick, John Meacham, the great historians, none of them think that American history is the story of misery and oppression. They think it's a story of glory. And their books sell. They sell to adults. Adults do pick up American history as they age when they see a book by Doris Kearns Goodwin or John Meacham or David McCullough, because they know they were shortchanged, and they were shortchanged in school. It is a tragedy. And a real disaster and a threat to our republic that a majority of high school seniors at age 18 get an F in knowing the country that they live in. As they get ready to go to college or vote or join the military or take on their first job. As they become adults, they are made aliens in a country they don't know. So we can talk about illegal aliens all day long, and there's a lot to talk about. But what of the much bigger crime, the much bigger moral and intellectual crime of making aliens of our own citizens, unaware and ignorant about their very own country? Isn't that equally deserving of attention? 602-5080-960. We'll be right back. That lyric, that set of lyrics, you want to repeat them, Bill? It's hilarious. Chinese, going to get a good, what is it? Good dish of beef chow mein? I don't know what he's talking about, but it's a good song. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Ed is in Scottsdale. Hello, Ed.
Hey, Seth. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, so you were just talking about, you know, historical amnesia.
Yeah. That's a good word for it. Amnesia, sure.
Yeah, so I graduated from Navy in 1973 when the Nixon hearings were going on. And, you know, I had no interest in it. I was apolitical. But I did meet one person who was just enthralled by the whole thing. And, you know, I kind of watched it as it unfolded. But I honestly can say to this day, I still don't really know exactly what happened. But what my point that I wanted to say is that it created a playbook that the Democrats have been using ever since. So you had Nixon, you know, they got rid of Nixon, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent. Then the next, they went after President Reagan with Iran-Contra. Then they went after H.W. Bush. I don't even remember why, but they indicted Cap Weinberger.
They indicted Cap Weinberger in the in the Iran-Contra thing. And right,
was
exactly.
That? Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so, and then it continued on. And then they went after people for so-called outing this, you know, faux CIA agent, Valerie Plame, who everybody knew who she was. And now we're reliving the same playbook. And so I think, you know, as long as the Republicans show some spine and stand up to it and ask, you know, some hard questions, it shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yes, you're right. This is, you know, I think the Democrats, by and large, have treated impeachment as politics by other means. Is that fair to say, Ed? Yes.
Yeah, that's basically my point. It's their basic playbook. They look for something.
What they don't get at the ballot box, they use the courts for, or impeachment, right? There is an election in less than a year. People could make their judgment about this stuff.
Yeah, but they tangle it up in so many legalisms. And by the way, after I did my first tour in a squadron, I became a lawyer in the Navy. So I kind of get this stuff, but they get everybody so tangled up in all these legalisms that you just throw up your hands and go, you know, the heck with it.
Ed, as long as we have a real live lawyer on the phone, help me out with this.
Yeah.
Because because I know a lot of people like to play lawyer, right? I'm sure that's frustrating to everyone in the legal profession, such as yourself. But the Democrats have moved from quid pro quo to now what they're trying to call bribery or attempted bribery. An element of attempted bribery, because it wasn't actual bribery, because they didn't know they were bribed and they got the money anyway.
Right.
You have to have a nefarious, a mens rea, an evil intent to commit that. It is one of those kinds of intent crimes, is it not?
I think so.
No, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure that's an element of the federal bribery statute.
Well, I mean, you know, Seth, you know this. There are millions, in fact, billions of negotiations that go on every day.
Right.
I give you this and you give me that.
Right.
So the quid pro quo is nothing. But like you say, what's the intent of what, I'm going to give you money in order to the law or throw someone in jail who shouldn't be. That's the kind of thing that bribery is. Or I will accept money in order to give you a benefit that I can do through my position as a government official.
Right.
I just don't see it at all.
Right. But, you know, it's going to be very hard to make the case that there was an evil or nefarious mens rea, an intent to bribe, as long as Donald Trump is saying it was an intent to get rid of corruption. That is not an evil intent.
Totally.
Okay.
Completely. And
that's why this case falls and fails.
They're barking up the wrong tree again.
Yeah, they'll have to find a new one. Thank you, Ed.
Take care, Seth.
Hey, thanks for your service.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is great. Do you remember? That's the scene in The Color of Money with, what's his name, shooting pool? Yeah, well, yeah, and the younger guy. Yeah, right, the younger guy. Probably the most A-list actor in Hollywood. Why am I drawing a blank on his name? This is what happens when you get older. In any event, Tom Cruise. This is the there are funny takes on what this song is about. Doing the werewolves. I saw a werewolf drinking a pina colada at Trader Vic's and his hair was perfect. Someone on one of the boards said, the message of the song is, werewolf owners, spay your pets. Spay your pets. John McVie and Mick Fleetwood are on that recording, playing drums and bass. Okay. That's our cultural segment for the hour. Doug is in Maricopa. Hi, Doug.
And a great cultural section it was.
Thank you, sir.
Yep.
How could I not remember Tom Cruise's name? That is scary.
Well, some of us try to forget it.
Okay, fair enough. Okay.
But in talking about the history here, I think your take on the loss of history was totally right on. But I would like to say that I think it's a little bit more nefarious than you think.
Okay.
I believe that it's intentional with the left because basically to rewrite the present and rewrite our rights, you have to first rewrite the past.
To be sure. Good. Yes.
And I think because if this is how the left turns the National Socialist German Workers' Party into a conservative Republican, when you couldn't be any more polar opposites, you have to first not know what Nazis are, and then you can convert it into anything else. It's how you turn racists of the past, whether Sanger or Wilson or Roosevelt, and you can turn them into great, great patriots.
And yeah, isn't it funny how we destroy Jefferson and we destroy Washington, and then we elevate people like Wilson, who trafficked in playing the movie The KKK at the White House, right? Or Margaret Sanger, who trafficked in, right? It's funny who we take down and who we build up.
And if you don't know about the past, you don't realize the absolutely frightening trend that is reoccurring. I would say history is reoccurring, whether you can compare, the Republican president during the Civil War, Lincoln and Trump, in terms of, elected with a minority of the population, but with the Electoral College, and how the Democrats hated him, Lincoln, for it, and how the Democrats today hate Trump. But it, also the frightening trend of the fact that the left is now moving back to group rights. If you are taught the importance of the rights of the individual, you will not succumb to the horrors of the left today, because one of the great arguments for group rights was Calhoun before the Civil War, when you had to do that, because if you thought of a black man as an individual, then he has the same rights as the white. But he began to group and say that as a group, the black man was better off in slavery, and as a group. So that was one of it. It's easier to begin to suppress rights and apply rights as the left is doing today by saying that the whites are evil as a group. They can't say you're a good man based on your life's work. They will begin to write you off, and they need to write you off so they can supplant events with their agenda on the left.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right, Doug. And it's even, I think you'll agree. We've got several themes running through this general show that I do here every day. And the other part of it that plays hand in glove with this, of course, is the frenzy that we're always put in, right? The confusion.
Right.
That we're always put in. And I think while they may not deliberately have sat down and said, okay, let's do X, Y, and Z, this feeds right into it. The constant distraction from the important, the constant focus on the frivolous over the critical, and the, as I say, frenzy that they whip us into such nothingness. Constitutional crisis we've been in for a year and a half now. I mean, that's a pretty strong phrase. A phrase reserved for, I don't know, maybe a president ordering the firing of a special prosecutor that an attorney general resigns over not doing, so that you end up with something called the Saturday Night Massacre. I mean, those kinds of things are properly called constitutional crises,
yeah.
I.e. 1973, 1974. Donald Trump not colluding with Russia is not a constitutional crisis.
Donald Trump
withholding aid for 55 days because he wants to investigate corruption is not a constitutional crisis. We are in no constitutional crisis. Things are going perhaps better in this country than they have maybe ever.
But Seth, we have to realize it is taken away from impeachment. This is a tactic of the left to make us go brain dead and coward.
Yeah.
Because everything is a crisis. If it's a crisis, we must defer our freedom and our thoughts.
You bet.
Just remember, I bring up the healthcare crisis.
Yeah.
Everything's a crisis.
Right.
Back in the 90s with the Clintons, it was the daycare crisis.
Right.
It is the environmental crisis.
Right.
We're
because
all
then you can
die.
Do anything you want, right? You can take
then
on
you can
extra
do anything
right.
you want.
Right.
It's a standard rule. It applies to everything. It's just their tactic, and we shouldn't succumb to it.
Yep.
You know. But hey, one other quick thing. You mentioned, I think, you know, that the judicial, that is what's sending the Democrats into a panic. And I think you're absolutely spot on, because this is how they legislate, is through the courts.
Yep.
But, again, it's half, because 90% of the laws that are applied to us are done with unelected bureaucrats.
Yep.
And basically Gingrich calls it bureaucratic socialism.
Yep.
They fear that every bit as much as losing the court.
You bet. You bet. Some people call it the deep state.
Yes.
If you don't
absolutely.
Think it operates, just watch these impeachment hearings. Thank you, Doug. God bless. On that American history theme, I'll just close with the words of David McCullough, who testified to the Senate in 2005, saying the midnight ride of Paul Revere, Stephen Vincent Benet's John Brown's Body, Fred Douglas's autobiography, Ben Franklin's autobiography, the speeches of Chief Joseph, Lincoln's second inaugural address, Grant's memoirs, selections from Shelby Foote and Barbara Tuchman, the wonderful prose of Francis Parkman, the Oregon Trail. The list could be indefinite. Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham jail, on and on. These are all not only major events in the history of our country, they are great literature. They have survived the test of time just as literature of a conventional kind has. And this could be exciting. This could bring young people and their teachers into a love of history, which is essential. But if we raise generation after generation of young Americans who are historically illiterate, we are running a terrible risk for this country. You could have amnesia of a society, which is as detrimental as amnesia of an individual. And of course, if people begin to think that all that we have, all that our blessings, our freedoms, our art, our music, our literature, our great institutions, the faith, the creed we have that held us together for 229 years in equality, and the idea all men are created equal, the ideal of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, if all of that seems to be something that just fell out of the sky, is just part of the natural world and that nobody struggled for it, there is no story behind it, then we are really, in my view, in the soup. Yep. Well said, David McCullough. Folks, we appreciate you very, very much. Thank you for spending some of your time with us and giving us some of your heart and brain and ear and soul. Until tomorrow, I'm Seth Leibson. God bless, and class dismissed.